We'll call the Judiciary Committee to order on the, what is it, the 7th day of March today. It's 1:35 today. We have Senator Kelly with us today. We have Senator Bishop. This is going to be his last committee, I think, potentially. There's a possibility we get a new member. We have Senator Costello. Welcome, Senator Wilkowski. Today we're going to do two bills in front of the committee. We're going to do Senate Bill 124, Senate Bill 124 by the Senator Giesel. Today my plan is just to let her bring the her best reason for this forward, go through the bill a little bit, answer questions, and we'll do public testimony probably starting on Monday. And that's probably where we'll head on this. And then the governor has a bill, Senate Bill 109. They just happen to be presenting in the other body right now. And so we're going to bring the Senate Bill 124 up first, and we'll give her the ample time, ask ample questions, and then we'll lay it aside. So, and then we'll do the same thing with Senate Bill 109. My intention is to bring it up, let the administration bring their best argument forward, and then we're going to lay that bill aside, and then we'll consider both of these next week for public testimony and comment. So if anybody's signed up for public testimony, it was not my intention to start that today, because as I was telling one of the priests here in the room, before I got in the legislature, I actually took off work to come testify, and they let the professionals testify for hours, and then us poor guys that took off work, we actually paid to come testify, couldn't even get on the list. And I think that's so unfortunate. So I want to make sure that when we do public testimony, we have ample time to do that. Today is the best reason for the bill that you're going to have. There's going to be arguments pro and con. We'll let those have their moment, and then we'll get public testimony. So for those if it came today, my apologies. That's generally how I do it here anyway. But welcome, members. I think what we'll do now is we'll just ask Senator Giesel if she'll come forward and with her staff. And let me bring this up. So I have Kari Knorr, who is staff, and Senator Giesel, who is a prime sponsor. And welcome, Senator Giesel. Please put yourself on the record and introduce Senate Bill 124 to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm State Senator Kathy Giesel. I represent Senate District N, as in November. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for hearing the Born Alive bill. The purpose of this bill is to give babies like this little one here in the picture that was delivered at 27 weeks that opportunity to be born alive. So the bill lays out some guidelines. It says, when performing or inducing an abortion, the physician shall use the method that provides the best opportunity for the unborn child to survive. It goes on to say that a child born alive as a result of this procedure shall receive the same degree of professional skill, care, and diligence to preserve the life and health of the child as a child born in the course of a natural birth at the same fetal age. In addition, that baby would have the opportunity to be surrendered should the mother be unable or feel unable to care for the child. She could surrender that child to a physician or employee of the hospital or facility right then and there, and the child could then be considered a child in need of aid. So the bill applies to all abortions performed or induced after the effective date, and the effective date is immediate. But why? Mr. Chairman, Roe v. Wade made some very clear statements about babies that are viable. The Supreme Court maintained that the state had an interest in protecting the life of a baby after viability, that being the capability of living outside the womb. Roe v. Wade went on to say that the compelling point is that viability, the ability of that baby to have a meaningful life outside the mother's womb. The protection of fetal life after viability has logical and biological justifications. It may go so far as to proscribe That word, in case you're not familiar with it, means forbid, especially by law, abortion during that period of viability this is referring to, except when necessary to preserve the life or health of the mother. So, in other court rulings, again, the viability definition was upheld. Here you see in this particular decision, the fetus is potentially able to live outside the mother's womb, albeit with artificial aid, and presumably capable of a meaningful life outside the mother's womb. Here's another court case, a 1997. Again, facing the issue of when a fetus is entitled to protection, the court held that a viable fetus was a person for the purposes of the Children's Code in South Carolina. So, what are we talking about here? What is this viable human life that we're talking about? Mr. Chairman, this is a picture that summarizes some of the sentinel events in the development of a human baby. You see when the heartbeat begins, week 5, vital organs are formed, week 8, eyelids form, week 6, brain waves, week 9, sucking thumb and yawning. But let's go a little bit more granular, and we'll start out here. Thank you. In the first trimester, that is prior to 12 weeks, 2 to 3 months, arms and legs are well formed, eyes and ears are forming, the heartbeat is heard, and the foundation of fingerprints actually begin to develop in this time. You'll see that by 14 weeks and moving forward, those fingerprints are beginning to develop. Now, I want to make a point about fingerprints, Mr. Chairman. In my profession, I often have to get criminal background checks done. Those are done based on my fingerprints because my fingerprints are unique to me. They identify me as a person, as a unique person, and a human being. That's how I got my concealed carry permit. We use fingerprints all the time. These babies are forming fingerprints at this early stage, Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman. I will also add that...
President. I said we'll take president.
Oh, you'll take president. Yes, well, I'll also add, Mr. Chairman, that it is at this age that in order to remove this baby from the uterus, it is not simply the vacuuming of a few cells out of the uterus. It is actually at this stage, and you can see what this baby looks like, that the procedure requires something called dilatation and evacuation. The new term, at least it's new to me, that's being attributed to this is something called dismemberment. So in order to remove this baby would actually have to be taken apart into pieces. We'll talk more about that later. So here we are at 6 months gestational age. Fingerprints and footprints are fully developed at this point. But more than that, Mr. President, during this time frame, Mr. Chairman, during this time is when the babies begin to suck their thumb, yawn, mother can feel baby moving, ultrasounds can identify the sex of the child, and by 20 weeks, it has been documented that these babies feel pain. So that's at 5 month gestation, 20 weeks. At 24 weeks, they're hiccuping, which means they certainly have a neurologic system going. Their inner ear is fully developed, and the baby actually responds to sounds. 24 weeks, that's 6 months. In the state of Alaska, this baby is still eligible to be aborted, Mr. Chairman. Many people don't realize that the state of Alaska has no prohibition on the removal of that baby from the uterus at this age through the procedure of abortion. Moving on, here we are approaching 7 months of age. Baby weighs about 2 pounds now. You can see the central nervous system is perking along. They've got breathing movements. They can control their body temperature. Here we are at 8 months. Fat layer is being deposited. Red blood cells are forming. The lungs are nearly fully developed. And they would be considered term as they approach 37 weeks. Again, Mr. Chairman, in Alaska, there's no limit on the age at which an abortion could be performed. It could still be performed at this age. And it would take quite a bit of dismemberment to remove a child of this size from the uterus, Mr. Chairman. So the concept of the Born Alive bill is that these babies would have the best opportunity to survive at the age of viability. In the second trimester, again, I've said this before, but that's after 14 weeks, 96% of abortion procedures are the DNE, dilatation and evacuation. This is actually a dismemberment. According to the Centers of Disease Control, 9% of all abortions are performed on these very developed people, these very developed babies, about 100,000 babies each year in the United States. Procedures, the dismemberment procedure is never medically necessary to preserve the life of the mother in acute medical procedures. The reason being, to dilate the cervix takes at least 36 hours. So if there is an emergency reason that the mother's life has to be preserved, to dilate the cervix and dismember this baby is not the appropriate approach. This goes on to describe a bit more about dismemberment. It's often guided by ultrasound. A forceps is inserted, and the physician feels around until they believe they have a grip on an extremity, and they pull. Mr. Chairman, the most difficult piece to remove is the head, and to do that, they have to crush it to remove it. And I'll stop there. I don't mean to offend anyone's sensibilities. This little person was sent to me. It was a picture sent to me by a mom. This is a 20-week-old gestational baby. You can see this is a fully formed baby. So what are the chances of viability, that is survival outside of the womb? So this is not necessarily the most updated, but it's pretty close to the survival rates estimates. There you see at 23 weeks or less, so that's after that five-month age when they can feel pain. It's about a 35% potential survival rate, and of course it goes up as gestational age goes up. Here you see, Mr. Chairman, again, not necessarily the latest data, but pretty close, what other countries and states do. We're one of the few states that has no limit on the age, gestational age, at which abortion can be performed. But you see, many countries do. You can see many countries say after 12 weeks, a prohibition on abortion. You see 16 weeks up to 24. Multiple states identify 20 weeks. And 20 states altogether have a statement of viability as the ban point on abortion. So taking that into account, remembering that the bill requires that if the baby is considered viable, then the abortionist needs to deliver that baby with the best chance of survival. This is just another example of a child that was born at 28 weeks. You can see she's got all of her arms and legs. She is being assisted. But at the same time, she grew up to be a very functional, beautiful young woman. You know, some people are opposing this bill, Mr. Chairman, because they say it doesn't make a meaningful difference. I've even heard the argument that, you know, this will only save maybe two or three lives in the state of Alaska. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I believe that is vastly underestimating the impact. But even more, Mr. President, every single life matters. And we have a lot of policies that preserve human life, and that's what this is about. Mr. Chairman, these are pictures of Alaskans. Alaskans who would not be here today if they had been conceived and their mothers had lived in Iceland. Here's why, Mr. Chairman. These Alaskans have Down syndrome, and the country of Iceland requires that mothers be tested for Down syndrome, and if the baby tests positive, then the parents are informed that they will be responsible for all medical costs and special education, etc. They are significantly discouraged from giving birth to these children. But, Mr. Chairman, that those tests for Down syndrome have 85% are only 85% accurate. There's a 15% error. So I suspect there are many many children without Down syndrome that are also aborted in Iceland. But regardless, these are four functional Alaskans. And let me show you some more functional Alaskans. These folks are actually living in our state today, performing jobs, functional people. That little girl at the top, she's an Icelandic child, and she made it through the test undetected. So that's pretty awesome. Sorry. She's just so cute. But, reminds me of her granddaughter. So, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I am reminded of Oscar Schindler. You know, at the end of that movie, all the Jews that he had saved, whose lives he had saved through his factory and bribing the German soldiers to allow him to have these Jewish folks to work in his factories, they met with him after the war was over, and they gave him a ring inscribed with this statement from the Talmud. Whoever saves a life, it is considered as if he had saved an entire world. So, Mr. Chairman, that's what this bill is about. What do American people say? I wanted to give you some poll results. So this is a recent poll that was done asking the question, should abortion be limited after 12 weeks at the end of the first trimester? You see there is 76% of Americans said yes, abortion should be limited after that point. And you see the breakdown of the various political perspectives of those people that were polled. And then when they were asked the question, should abortion be prohibited for genetic issues such as Down syndrome, still 64% of Americans agreed with that. So this is very much in keeping with the sentiments of Americans. There are 8 states that have identified 20 weeks as the cutoff in their states. This is being challenged in 6 of those states, but 2 of them have implemented it. This bill is essentially the federal bill that was put forward and failed to pass the Senate just by a small margin last month. The only difference in this bill is that we don't identify a viability age, because that's constantly changing with technology. And it does not have a penalty in it. So if those are things that this committee is interested in adding to the bill, I'm certainly not opposed to that. I was just making it as broad as possible to hopefully hit the mark here of saving these children's lives. We know that they can live productive lives outside the womb, and we want to give them a chance to be born alive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just on the opening statement, questions, Senator Kelly.
Senator Giesel, and just for the people who may be watching this tape, it almost sounded as if your bill would include abortion for genetic issues such as Down syndrome, and you didn't mean to say that. So I just wanted to make sure that nothing in your bill is encouraging abortions for issues such as Down syndrome. And as you said it just kind of stuck that it could be misunderstood, and I wanted to clarify that. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kelly, through the chair. I absolutely did not mean that. I will have to be more careful about my wording in the future. Absolutely not. I was calling out Iceland as an example of how far this mandate of abortion can go. These are productive individuals and absolutely should be given the opportunity to be born alive.
You actually said it in the portion about the poll. It wasn't in that.
Senator Kelly. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My research that I've done shows that the earliest that a premature baby can survive is 21 weeks and maybe 4 days, 5 days. Is that about what your research shows?
That is approximately the present. However, if you'll recall, technology is always improving, and so that's why no date is named in the bill.
Senator Wilkowski.
And I think your office provided this document. It's 2016 induced termination of pregnancy statistics. Is that from yours?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is the most recent state statistics that I had access to.
Okay. And
Senator Wilkowski, continue.
Question, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Just looking at page 6, it says that nearly all 99.5% of induced terminations in Alaska were performed at 13 weeks or less gestational age. Do you have any reason to dispute that figure?
I have no reason to dispute that.
Okay. So would this bill require doctors to – well, I guess a different question.
Senator, what we'll do is we'll go through the sectional, and I think we'll get into the more specific things.
Okay.
So just the broader questions, please continue. But I just want to let you know we will go through a sectional here shortly.
All right. Maybe I'll wait for the sectional, Mr. Chairman.
Right. So any other questions, comments? Just from me, this has been an issue that's been near and dear to my heart, so I am greatly appreciative of the Senator bringing this forward. We travel in kind of interesting times here because this question quite often is kicked around as a moral issue, a legal issue, and a political issue, and it's really a child issue. But because of Roe versus Wade, it's become a legal issue because we're trying to find ways to value the life under the rule of law the best we know how. And so, therefore, many people who are from my part of the world who are very, very pro-life see that this doesn't ever go far enough. And I understand that because they would like to see overturned the Roe versus Wade decision. We're not in that place to do that. On the other hand, you're going to see people talk about the women's right issue, and this preserves that the best we know how, and still giving the child a chance to be treated well. So what I'd like to do, Senator Giesel, is have you go ahead and go through the sectional, and then at that point I'm going to open it up for questions. And my expectation is, if we can get it to within the next half an hour, then I will probably bring the administration up for the other bill, lay this one aside, and then we'll go into other debate and public testimony. It's not going to be this Friday, unfortunately. It'll have to start on Monday. And so is that all right with you, Senator Wilkowski? Senator because I have a feeling we're losing too many people for Friday, and it would be unwise for just the chairman to sit and take public testimony. I think that would be disappointing to many people in the public. So please continue with the sectional.
All right. Good afternoon. For the record, Kari Noor, staff to Senator Giesel. So the bill before you, Senate Bill 124, version U, beginning in Section 1, it amends AS 1816010 by adding new subsections to provide for a physician to use the best method of terminating the pregnancy that best provides for the unborn child to survive outside the mother's womb. It requires health practitioners present at the procedure to exercise the same degree of professional practice and diligence to preserve the life of the viable child born as would be provided to a child born through the course of natural birth. It provides definitions for alive, clinical judgment, fertilization, and fetal age. Section 2 amends AS 1816 by adding a new section that would allow a parent of a child born alive during the process of an abortion to surrender the child to a physician or employee of the hospital. The person to whom the child has been surrendered will notify the Department of Health and Social Services as required under AS 4710-013-D. Section 3 amends AS 4710-011 and adds a provision in the Child in Need of Aid China statute to include a child born alive during the termination of a pregnancy whose parent is unwilling or unable to care for the infant. Section 4 adds an applicability provision that states that AS 1816-010-K through M, added by Section 1 of this bill, AS 1816-012, added by Section 2, and AS 4710-011, as amended in Section 3, apply to all abortions performed or induced on or after the effective dates of those sections. Section 5 provides an immediate effective date for this act.
Thank you. Senator Wilkoski, you wanted to go to a couple of questions. Yes. from the section.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just on Section 1, it says the physician shall use the method of terminating the pregnancy that provides the best opportunity for the unborn child to survive. Which methods of abortion actually allow for the child to survive?
Senator
Wilkoski, through the chair. That would be an induced delivery. In other words, instead of dilating the cervix and reaching in with the forceps and pulling the baby apart in pieces to actually induce labor and deliver the baby, rotate the baby so it would be head down, because at these ages they're typically with their head up, up being from gravity, I guess, the orientation would be. But so, rotating the baby and delivering.
Senator Wilkoski.
Is that, not to get too, well, I'm just looking at, again, this document that was provided us from your office, from the Division of Public Health. Is induced labor a form of abortion? Is that a method of abortion, or is that a method of delivery?
It's a method of delivery. Okay. That's right.
Is there a contemplation that a hysterotomy is a safer method to do an abortion? Or a C-section?
You're talking about a C-section. Yeah. Of course. And frankly, if this were an emergency, that would be what would be done, because a D&E, which we've already talked about, takes a minimum of 36 hours to dilate the cervix. And so if this is a question of saving the life of the mother, a C-section would be the approach.
C-section, that's major surgery?
Some regard it as such. It's become actually rather minimal surgery.
And according to the records I've seen, it's a woman's probably got a staff work for 6 weeks after a C-section.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. Say it again. I couldn't hear it.
According to some of the documents I've seen, after a C-section, a woman is recommended to stay off of work, well, stay in the hospital for 2 to 3 days and then stay off of work for 6 weeks. Is that sound about right?
Senator Wilkoski, through the chair, the recovery from a C-section is quite a bit faster than that these days. I can't, it depends on the woman and their fundamental health, so a blanket statement really couldn't be made there, and I don't know what kind of work the woman is doing that would require her to stay off. I don't know.
Okay. And then just...
Yeah, I could tell you from a perspective of my daughter, who had twins in a C-section, she had 2 days with the twins resting, is what... some people said, and then she got up and went to work. So anyway, that's just a practical experience with twins. So, Senator Wilkoski.
So just looking at this document from the Mayo Clinic, and they say after a C-section, you face a higher risk of potentially serious complications in a subsequent pregnancy, including problems with the placenta. Is that something you would agree with?
Senator Wilkoski, through the chair. The number of C-sections done in this country now are phenomenal. I'll look up the number for you. It has become a very common procedure. So to state that this somehow jeopardizes future pregnancies or the life of the mother is a tremendous overstatement and dramatization. It is, frankly, a rather routine way of delivering babies these days.
Yeah, that's just a direct quote from the Mayo Clinic, Mr. Chairman. So the earliest known fetus that survived is 21 weeks and 4 days. How many abortions in Alaska are done after 21 weeks in the last 5 years?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I believe you actually cited the document that has that information in it, so I suspect you already have an answer in mind. But if you'll turn in that document to page 11, you will see 2016 data for Alaska's induced termination of pregnancy statistics. Now, what's interesting about these statistics is the category of not stated, which has dramatically fallen. There is question whether not stated is actually not wanting to admit what the age of the child was, because the numbers, of course, on very early abortion procedures or terminations are quite robust, and then we get 88, 78, and then suddenly they fall down. So I can't explain that data, but you have the numbers right there.
So just it was zero in 2016, is that right?
In 2016.
For 21 to 24 weeks?
It states zero, but it also has four that are not stated for some reason. In addition, if you consider the viability of children even at 20 weeks, we see two right there from 17 weeks to 20. So technology is always improving. And again, the question is, isn't every life worth saving? We spend a lot of time and money supporting the disabled because they're worth it as well. So these lives are worth it as well.
So, Senator Wilkowski.
If the lowest recorded age for a surviving fetus is 21 weeks in world history, would, as far as we both know, would abortions before that time, would the doctor be required to perform a different type of procedure?
Senator, before she answers that, that information on the world stats, can you get that to us as a committee?
Yeah, I mean, I just got two documents. Sure.
That would be just good for us to have on the record.
Yeah, so, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure there's somebody else.
Since I haven't seen it, I thought share it with the committee, and then I'll let the senator answer the question from there. But I would like to have that information. Thank you.
Yes.
Senator,
and if I'm wrong,
Eason,
please correct me.
You want him to restate the question since I interrupted?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would. I've forgotten what the question
okay.
was.
Okay. And I'm sorry, Senator. I just thought it would be good to ask for the information so that we all have it. Would you restate the question?
Yeah, no, please? My office just went and tried to find out some information. And one document we found said James Elgin Gill was born May 20th, 1987, was the earliest premature baby in the world. He was 128 days premature, which is 21 weeks and 5 days. And then there, we found another document recently which said there was a baby born 21 weeks and 4 days. So there, I mean, it could be something different. We just haven't found it.
No, thank you. I appreciate that.
But I'm just curious, would doctors, if this will pass and goes into effect immediately, the earliest the fetus that survived is 21 weeks, would doctors before that have to perform either induced labor or a hysterotomy?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this is left to the professional judgment of the physician, who, by the way, takes an oath to do no harm. Gestational age is, frankly, guesswork. It is often incorrect. And so to set a particular date, again, is not advisable in these situations. And it is left up to the professional judgment of the physician in this case.
And maybe I could chime in. Is the technology, we have improved our technology on ultrasound in a significant way. Is that something that has shown better survival rates, or is there anything that can tell us the value to the doctor is what I'm looking at. So is that anything that has come to light through this discussion?
Mr. Chairman, an ultrasounds are definitely valuable in pregnancy. In fact, there are many organizations that do ultrasounds for free for mothers that are facing crisis and not sure what to do. And the thing that's very interesting is that when those mothers, and often those fathers as well, see that little person, they change their mind because suddenly they see the arms and legs and the little face. Absolutely, ultrasounds are very helpful in determining more closely gestational age and viability.
Thank you. Senator Lutowski, to continue.
Oh, yeah, thank you. No, I'm just trying to understand the way the bill works because, and since 99.5% of all abortions are done at 13 weeks or earlier, is it possible to induce pregnancy, labor, or perform a hysterectomy that would save the child's life at 13 weeks?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, at some point in technology and medical development, that may be true. Thus, the bill doesn't limit the age.
Well, I can tell you the technology has improved, but it's also a focus that we've had in other arenas. For example, we tried to get a telephone line into certain areas of the interior, and because of eagle's nest and eggs in those eagle's nest, we could not do it. So, I mean, it's the perspective. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there, and we're continually trying to figure out ways to improve how we guard that life. And so, Senator, please continue.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, if the technology were to improve, then any woman who wanted an abortion would have to have a C-section, get cut open, and have the baby removed. Is that accurate?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that is a very dramatic statement that the bill does not make.
That's the effect of the bill, is it not?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. It is not the effect of the bill. The bill says, in the professional judgment of the physician, if viability is likely, then the best opportunity for survival must be given to the baby.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, is there a penalty to the physician is there like criminal penalties or anything if they violate this provision?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, a few minutes ago I pointed out that that was something that is not in the bill and that I would certainly be open to that if someone wished to add it, but I purposely did not put a penalty into the bill. You know, the ethics of the professional physician are called into action here, and it is up to their professional judgment.
Yeah, fourth question.
Yeah, just on the definition of, we're getting into page 2, line 5 through 7, and it talks about how if the unborn child is removed from the pregnant woman's womb alive, and then it just gets into a definition of alive. Is that, you define it as removal from pregnant woman's womb has spontaneous respiratory or cardiac function or pulsation of the umbilical cord. And does that mean spontaneous respiratory or cardiac function after they're removed from the womb?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that's what it says. After birth or removal from the womb, has spontaneous respiration and cardiac activity.
And I'm just trying to understand what that means. That means they're able to breathe on their own, or their heart probably will beat, right? Pulsation of the umbilical cord, I assume that happens probably at a very, very, I mean, I don't know the details like you do, but I assume there's pulsation very, very, very early on.
Pulsation of the umbilical cord indicates the circulatory system is actually functioning, that the heart is contracting and blood is flowing. Thank you. Pardon me, and through the chair, Senator Lukowski. My pardon.
And I appreciate you being willing to answer the questions. And I think since you not only have done the research but are also a practicing nurse, you're able to help us think through some of these things. One of the things that, because of the report that the senator keeps quoting off of, and you have in your packet there on the induced termination of pregnancies in Alaska, we have required the doctors to report these stats. And I don't know that there's a penalty, but I think if I was going to look at a place for accountability, I would start there. And so I'm just bringing it up for, as a topic of discussion, since they are the ones that are going to be at least liable at this point for determining viability. There might be some benefit we can offer them and some reporting that we can offer them, and I will ponder how we might get that into this bill. But it's also true that after looking at that report, it looks to me like the fiscal note that the department gave us is probably going to be easily challenged. So I just I wanted to bring that up for your perusal, because they put a significant fiscal note on it, which I'm willing to pay. I think if we have a child and we bring it into the world and it's in need of aid and it requires extra help, I think we give it to them. But based on the stats that you've been showing, Senator Wilkowski, I don't know that we're going to head down that road very far. So, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. Just looking at the definitions in that same report we were just referencing from the Department of Health and Social Services, there's it has the different termination, induced termination procedures on page 18 and 19. And you had said there were two ways, two methods of terminating a pregnancy that provide the best opportunity. One was the hysterotomy. And you said induced labor, and I'm just curious which one of these, maybe I don't just know the terms like you do, but which one of these is induced labor?
Mr. Chairman, so I can follow.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's on page 18.
It's page 18 of this this document.
And this is the termination of pregnancy report?
It's right. It's 2016 Alaska induced termination of pregnancy statistics released February 2017. And then on page 18, it talks about induced termination. And it's got a list of the procedures. And I'm just wondering which one of those is the induced labor procedure. I don't see it on here.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, looking at page 18, what you're looking at is the second definition, induced termination of pregnancy. And it clearly states, you'll see the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 words, which does not result in a live birth. So you're right. None of these listed procedures would result in a live birth. There's no way that induced delivery, induced labor would be listed here. It's not a way to kill the baby.
Okay, but to the good Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, that's why there's a difference between I think what we need to do is this will be part of the instructions to the termination of pregnancy. So please continue, Senator.
Right. And just going back to the wording of the way the bill's written, page one, it says, when a physician performs or induces an abortion in the state, the physician shall use the method of terminating the pregnancy that provides the best opportunity for an unborn child to survive. So induced labor is not a method of terminating the pregnancy. So the only method of terminating the pregnancy is a hysterotomy, which is a C-section. And so this would require every woman in the state of Alaska that wants an abortion to get a C-section, as long as the doctor deems in his clinical judgment that that's the best way to save the child. Am I reading that wrong?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'm somewhat tempted to suggest you might be practicing medicine without a license. Terminating a pregnancy means delivery of the baby. So these methods that you've identified on page 18 are induced termination procedures that does not result in a live birth. So the normal way that pregnancies are terminated is with a delivery of a baby.
Well, I don't.
Senator Lukasik.
Yeah, by no means am I have any degree of medical expertise, but I'm just looking at the words in your section one where you say the physician shall use the method of terminating the pregnancy that provides the best opportunity for the unborn child to survive. And induced labor is not a method of terminating the pregnancy, it's a method of delivering a child. So by your words in your statute that you've proposed, the only method of terminating the pregnancy that would provide the unborn child an opportunity to survive is a hysterectomy, which is a C-section.
So to add to that point, Senator Kelly?
If it says the purposeful interpretation of pregnancy, interruption of pregnancy, which the intention other than to produce a live born infant or to remove a dead fetus.
Senator, could you move the microphone for those?
Which does not result in a live birth. So you have the termination of the pregnancy, which is the termination of the pregnancy. That's what the patient went in there for, but they go in there in such a manner as the doctor, in their judgment, terminates the pregnancy without a live birth. That doesn't mean you have to perform a C-section. It doesn't follow. I don't see the sequence here that it follows that has to result in a C-section. It has to result, or the idea is to terminate the pregnancy, which inducing of birth, whether the baby is alive or not, terminates the pregnancy.
And I might add,
it doesn't seem to follow that therefore you have to have a C-section to do that.
And I might add, with the language in this bill, it would be added termination of pregnancy which results in a live birth, and it would just be added to the stats here. So Senator Giesel.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The subject of C-section came up because that is a method of terminating a pregnancy and certainly would be employed if the mother's life were in jeopardy and this were an emergency procedure. Dismemberment of a child that is viable is not an emergency procedure because it takes at least 36 hours to dilate the cervix using the procedures that are done for a D&E, dilatation and evacuation.
You're not seeking to ban D&Es in this bill, are you?
I'm sorry, Senator,
I didn't hear.
Would you just restate the question, please?
You're not seeking to ban D&Es in this bill, are you?
You're asking if I'm seeking to ban dilatation and evacuation.
Yes.
They are procedures called dismemberment. That's what we've been speaking about since I began.
Are you seeking to ban them under this law?
These babies are of such a size that this is not simply vacuuming out a few cells, as some people characterize it. It's actually dilating the cervix, entering the cervix with a tool that grasps pieces of babies, arms, legs, etc., and dismembers them.
The point of controversy, though, as I see it at this point, or discussion, is at the point where the doctor describes it as viable. And this is where some pro-life activists would chime in and say it should never be dismembered at any stage, which I would agree with. But this is at least giving the place where the doctor sees the individual as a viable, the choice of the mother remaining what they choose, then the viability becomes a question, which would rest on the doctor, as I understand it, Senator. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, viability is the total basis of the bill.
Right.
Thank you.
So, well, with that, I thank you. You've asked and answered and got highlighted many of the points and some suggestions even for change, which we'll look at. My intention is to have public testimony on this come up for Monday. And then I would like to see amendments prepared for the Wednesday. And if we can bring the amendments up Wednesday and debate the bill, at that point, we'll see how the public testimony and debate goes. My intention is to move it out either Wednesday or Friday. And I know you're gone on Friday, I think, traveling. So Wednesday would be my preferred date, but in your absence, we might have to move it along. So if we can, we'll see how the votes go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate the questions, the debate. I think we got picked down to the particular parts of the issue. Let me take a brief at ease while I talk to my staff about where we're at. Call the Judiciary Committee back to order. Thank you for your patience. The problem of having a House and a Senate Judiciary Committee meetings at the same time, at the same day.
Really?
So we're going to bring before us today Senate Bill 109, which is brought to us by the governor. And we have Genevieve with us today, and we have, I have Eric Gaffney, who is Public Safety and Criminal Records online, and I understand that we're going to have some other testimony.
Mr. Chairman, before we do, I just wanted to make a comment here that the first line 8 of the bill, we start off the bill with Section C, which is very close to C-section.
That's that is really tough legal humor for this committee.
Oh, dear.
So, Genevieve, your misfortune to start on that note. But put yourself on the record and introduce this particular bill for us, the reason why, and if we should pass it, what it looked like when we pass it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Genevieve Watusik, Department of Revenue Legislative Liaison, happy to be here today to talk about Senate Bill 109. This is relating to background checks of state employees. Federal publication 1075 that the IRS published in September 30 of 2016 came up with new guidelines that said anybody that goes that gets federal data needs to have these background checks. And so the only thing that we're not in compliance with right now is the fingerprinting portion of that bill, of that publication. So it's a two-page bill, and I'm happy to walk through the sectional of just what each section does if you'd like.
Sounds like a pretty simple reason why, so let's just get right to the bill.
Sure. Section 1 amends AS 1262-400 by adding a new subsection requiring an agency to submit the fingerprints of current or prospective employees or contractors whose job duties require access to federal tax information. That's defined in AS 3955-015-E3 and 36.30.960-D3 to the Department of Public Safety for submission to the FBI to obtain a criminal history record. That section also defines agency, employee, and contractor. Section 2 amends AS 3630, adding a new section, establishes state personnel procedures for obtaining and submitting fingerprints for current or prospective contractors if a contract with a state requires access to federal tax information, or FTI, defines agency, contractor, and federal tax information. Section 3 amends AS 39, adding a new chapter. That chapter addresses state personnel procedures related to federal tax information. As AS 3955-010, that section explains the purpose of the chapter to establish procedures to safeguard FTI, federal tax information, which will apply to a current or prospective state employee whose job duties require access to federal tax information. It also adds AS 3955-015. That section requires current or prospective state employees whose job duties require access to federal tax information to provide info to an agency for a state or national criminal history records check. Defines agency, employee, federal tax information, return, and return information. Section 4 is the effective date. And since we put the bill forward last year, it had the effective date of July 1, 2017. That would need to be amended to 2018 if you so choose.
Good point. We will see to that. So just for me, the top question is, what was happening at the federal level that began to have this requirement come forward?
They go through these federal publications every so often, and this one just happened to come under that, and that was September of 2016 that finally happened.
Questions for the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in the remote possibility that a employee didn't want to be fingerprinted, would they have the option of being reassigned to another department on a job that didn't require fingerprints?
So for the Department of Revenue, it's two divisions, and that's tax and it's child support. And in those divisions, you are under, you do get that federal information, so you would need to have that. I don't think it's come up that if someone didn't want to submit that. They already get background checks. Mm-hmm. This is just the fingerprinting portion of that. So to look at that federal information, they will need to be fingerprinted to have that. So that would, everybody in those divisions would need to be fingerprinted, because you can't, through the chair, sorry, like say, don't look at this. You know, we'll, you know, you guys just look at this information and we'll have all this other information closed off to you, because you're able to access all of that information.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I understand. I just was wondering, maybe if they, you know, are transferred to another division within a state, you know, classification, maybe it's somewhere that doesn't require that, you know, just as a just a point of order from on my point, from my perspective.
So Genevieve, Senator Wilkowski also has a question.
Thank you. Just on that point, is in TSA, if you don't want to go through the MRI type of thing that they have, they let you do a pat down. Is there there's no sort of other way if someone, because I've had people, and I know Alaskans are very, very, some reluctant to give their fingerprints. I know people who have refused to take the CPA exam, for example, because they didn't want to give their fingerprints. Is there another method? Can you maybe some sort of heightened scrutiny that they can go through to avoid giving up their fingerprint information?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the federal FBI has said that they would need this to do that full background check. So that's why we've added it into this language. They didn't give any other, you know.
Senator, maybe what I can do is we do have public safety criminal records people online, and we have Director of Child Support Services. Maybe they've had somebody that has said they just don't want to do it, and whether that becomes an employment problem now or under this or if there's another way. So let's start with Eric Gaffney and see if there's some reason that if somebody didn't, if they would opt them out of being able to work with these records, or is there another method? And so, Eric, are you there, and can you hear us? Probably put us on mute. Well, we'll hold off on that for a second, and we'll go to Carol Beecher, who's also online with the Director of Child Support Services. And maybe, Carol, if you could tell us, is there somebody in your under your authority that, if they refuse to do it, would it just opt them out of being able to handle this information, or is there another methodology?
Chairman Coghill, this is Carol Beecher for the Alaska Child Support Services Division. And my understanding from the reading of Publication 1075, there is no option in this agency. If they do not undergo the fingerprint background check, then they could not work here.
Have you had, at this point, any pushback from employees that felt that this would be too onerous for them?
Chairman Coghill, we have not. In fact, we've had many people come forward with confessions and told them they don't need to know those things. So we have not had any pushback.
Okay. All right. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. When I look at the definition of agency, it means department, office of the governor, or entity in the executive branch, including University of Alaska, public or quasi-public corporation, board or commission, and Alaska Railroad Corporation. Basically, it covers the entire executive branch, as far as I can tell, and then some. Do you have an estimate of how many employees would be required to give fingerprints?
This would be Genevieve.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, just those that receive federal information. So we haven't, I don't know how many in the executive branch would be qualified for that. Can we enter that?
Is that information you'd like to percolate up? Maybe that's something Genevieve could go back and do a little research, and we could, before we pass this thing out of committee, it'd be nice to know how many would generally handle this information under this procedure, because you're establishing whole new procedures. that are really federally driven. My guess is anybody that's done anything in the support services, quite often in Medicaid, if they deal with IRS in any way. So
through the chair, yeah. Yes, Hess is affected by this. And then for revenue, it's 200 tax employees and about 100 child support employees, so 300 within revenue.
Okay. That's nice to know. Thank you. Yeah. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah. And, yeah, if you could dive into that a little bit, I'd be curious, because it would seem to me if you're University of Alaska, for example, and you're in financial aid, I guess you're coming across tax information and boards and, I don't know, about other boards or commissions, probably not so much, I would guess not so much on boards and commissions, but I don't know. I'm just curious. And then what kind of assurances can Alaskans have that this data will be kept safe?
I'm going to let Carol answer that if I could.
Carol, if you could put yourself on the record and answer Senator Wilkowski's question.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm sorry, I'm having a really hard time hearing you. Could you please repeat the question?
Yeah, what sort of assurances can Alaskans have that their fingerprint information will be kept safe?
Through the chair, we don't, if you're talking about the information received from the fingerprints, because we, as an agency, we don't receive the actual fingerprint information. And when we get the background check done, we have what's called Criminal Investigation Unit, sorry. And they are the ones who would receive the information. And we have, based on the criteria that we have of the crimes that are a nexus to the job, which are crimes of dishonesty, crimes of anything having to do with, crimes against children types of things. Those are the crimes that are specific to the jobs that we're looking at, financial crimes, because those are the types of things that we deal with in our agency. So we don't even see the other information that would come in on somebody. Does that answer your question?
So what I'm hearing from you is that basically the state doesn't possess this information. It's just, is that correct?
It would go into the criminal investigation unit, and they would receive it. And I believe that unless it's information that is germane to the nexus to the job for the background information, then they would destroy it. But I can find out for sure what they're doing once they get that.
Carol, I do have Eric Gaffney, who it looks like he's still on the line. So, Mr. Gaffney, are you there? Probably what we did. Are you there, Eric Gaffney?
Yes, I'm sorry, I'm here.
Oh, good. Have you heard the question on the security of these records and what we can use them for in the state?
There are state and federal policies governing. I'm assuming this means the criminal history results that are returned from a fingerprint submission.
Well, Senator Wilkowski, would you like to clarify your question?
Yeah, I just want to make sure that Alaskans aren't going to get their fingerprints taken and then have it end up in some big database that gets hacked into. I mean, you can use fingerprints for all sorts of things. You get into iPhones now with people's fingerprints. So I'm just curious what kind of safety protections there are and what the plans are to do with the fingerprints after they're captured.
The fingerprints, as things currently stand, will be received into the ABIS archive, maintained by the state for other civil fingerprints and criminal fingerprint submissions. And I'm not an IT person, and I can't speak exactly to the security procedures governing that, but it's a database. It's actually, Alaska is a member of an organization called the Western Identification Network with several other Western states. And criminal justice agencies in those states can also access the same archive, but they would be subject to the same procedures as persons currently going through civil fingerprint processes, including doctors, nurses, persons working with children, et cetera. The prints would also be conveyed to the FBI. And as things now stand, the FBI is not retaining those. There is, under current state law, There is not a way for us to ask the FBI to retain them. There are some agencies that may want the FBI to retain the principal longer so they can get updates on national criminal history. But right now, the FBI uses them for a comparison and then does not retain them.
Senator Wilkowski?
On the cost, can someone tell me how much it costs to obtain these fingerprints? And then is that something that you contemplate being paid for by the employee or the employer?
So would that be Genevieve or?
Yeah, let's start there. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. It's going to be a total cost of $47. And that's DPS's charge for that. And it'll be the employer that will cover that. The state.
Is there a fiscal note with this?
We do. We've got it forthcoming. It's not in the packet today, but it is forthcoming. We were updating it from last year's, so it's the same as last year's, but it's just a 2018 version. But it's a small fiscal note. And also through the chair, Brandon Spanos, our deputy.
Yeah, I see. Brad Spanos came in. We're double duty, everybody, from one side of the house to the other. You can sure come to join the table. And so Genevieve's done a good job of opening up. We've got the subject before us. It's been fairly well defined. We've been talking about security of the information. And the reason for it is probably less problematic than the security or the privacy of our Alaskans. The question just came up on fiscal note, which I think is being worked. So Genevieve's done a good job of answering those questions. In the other body, was there questions on the security of the information and the access that we might have in Alaska that that you've been able to dig deeper into?
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you, and apologize that that one went a little longer.
Put your name on the record, please.
For the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Department of Revenue Tax Division. And to respond to your question, yes, the other body did have concerns with the security of information. There were quite a few questions on that topic. The chair eventually wanted to limit questions just to the fingerprinting part of the bill because there was some concern of the security. And we do have a lot of policies in place for the security. That's not part of the bill. The bill is just simply asking for fingerprinting to do a background check to verify that that our employees are indeed honest, or rather that they haven't been convicted of a crime of dishonesty, but yes, we do take security quite serious, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So, any questions at this point, Senator Wilkowski? And then, did you have some, Senator?
Okay. Yeah, I'm just curious. Have other states just complied with this, or is anyone rising up and opposing it? And what are the consequences if we don't pass this?
Through the chair, Representative Wilkowski, it's the IRS has been talking about making this change for quite some time, and has discussed it with the states. There's been a lot of teleconferences between the Safeguard Security section of the Internal Revenue Service and the various states, and I think the states were pretty had voiced most of their concerns during all of that. And the final publication, when it was finalized, had background checks and fingerprinting as part of those the new requirements. So far, 26 states have passed legislation that allow them to do fingerprinting and the background checks. There are 13, including us. There's 14 states that have legislation before their legislators, and there are 8 that have no bill pending. And I'm uncertain whether some of those states may or may not actually have a need for a bill in order to do the fingerprinting. They may be able to do it without a bill.
Is there just follow up
on that? The follow up on that, and then Senator Costello.
Is there a timeline on when this would need to be passed and when we would stop getting this federal information?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. Apologize, I came from the other body. Senator Wilkowski, the. And I believe your last question also included that I didn't respond to what would happen if we don't pass the legislation. If we didn't pass it, the IRS would likely have a finding on an audit. They're coming up here in May to audit us. They would likely have a finding that would say that you still haven't passed legislation. Eventually, I suspect that they would stop sharing their federal tax information with us, which for the tax division, that would mean that we would Right now, we would bring in about $2 million a year for where we piggyback a federal audit. So the IRS does an audit on a corporation. They share that information with us, and we piggyback it and receive about $2 million. There was one year within the last 5 years where we got $13 million from federal piggyback audits. And so we would lose that. We would also lose the ability to get certain information on certain taxpayers like tobacco, mining, and alcohol taxpayers where we use federal tax information on our audits. And then child support services would lose the ability to collect money from the federal refunds that are due to taxpayers. They're able to take that money and pay it for if somebody owes child support. And as well as they also receive 66% of their funding, that would be a potential loss as well from the federal government. And when do we have to have this legislation passed? There is no deadline that I'm aware of. The IRS, of course, federal government realizes that it takes time for legislation to pass. I suspect that we're on a two-year cycle audit, so it's in May is when our next audit is. I suspect it would come up again in the next couple of years, or maybe they would follow up. It depends on how interested they are in it, or I can't really answer it.
Senator Costello, you had a question.
Yes, thank you. So my question is along the same lines as the security, and I'm curious if we could see the paperwork that is required if this were to pass. So they must submit to and pass a background investigation. I am assuming there's some sort of form or paperwork that the individual would fill out, and I'm curious what that looks like. And then also in that, is the person required to submit their social security number on such a form, or and then what happens, what does the state do with that information, the social security number?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, the form within the tax division, we've gotten it down to a front and back page. It's about 1.5 pages, and it requires name, aliases, former names, social security number, locations that you've lived in for the last 10 years, I believe, as well as convictions, their dates, whether it was a misdemeanor or felony, there was another column in that, I can't remember if it was what the punishment was, something like that, and then a signature allowing us the permission to run the background check. So the bill before you is granting authority to do the fingerprinting. We already have a policy in place that allows us to do the background check. We put that policy in place just after the IRS finalized their publication 1075, which was last year, and we've run the background checks on current employees and all of our new employees, but it's just state background check. We can't do the federal piece without the fingerprinting. And the information that's returned is criminal history. We don't run that ourselves. We give that to our criminal investigation unit. So there's an agency within the Department of Revenue that has criminal investigators. They investigate tax fraud and things like that for us. We give the questionnaires to the criminal investigators. They run the background for us, and then they give us a pretty clean sheet that either says the employee passed the background check or that there was some concerns on the background check for crimes of dishonesty. And we will, and then we would review that to determine whether we would retain or non-retain or potentially hire or not hire the employee based on that information. And then it's retained by the criminal investigation unit. We don't actually keep the background check within our agencies. We do keep the record that it was run. So when the IRS comes and audits us, they can see that we ran a background check on all of our employees and what the result was.
So the social security number that's supplied at the time that the application is filled out, what happens to that application, that social security number?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, it would be retained in a locked file by the criminal investigation unit within the Department of Revenue, and that's also behind a locked and secure door. So it's double locked.
Same thing with DMV, which we've all struggled with.
Mr. Chair, the state used to print our social security numbers on our dividend checks. And when my son was born 13 years ago, someone in the neighborhood here in Juneau was stealing mail. The check was not forwarded to Anchorage. I had my identity stolen along with 10 other individuals in this community and spent quite a bit of time fighting that. So I understand the personal, you know, experience of someone having their identity stolen. The person was a federal employee. Several of her victims were people she supervised. She got their Social Security numbers off of their employment paperwork. And when my child was an infant, I would go down to the police station and wait with him for a police officer who eventually I could talk to one, and we actually, the person actually did serve time in prison. So I'm asking these questions, and I think they're, you know, I appreciate the comment that, you know, this bill is something different, but I do think that, you know, as public servants, that we have to be on the lookout to protect Alaskans when they're asked to provide this kind of information. And so I have a personal and also a public reason for asking about the Social Security numbers, because I think that that's something that is, you know, I think we all worry about that.
Sure.
Especially the online portion, which I think is even more vulnerable than perhaps the hard copy versions.
Right. Through the chair, Senator Costello, we're also very concerned with privacy and confidential information. Our employees work with a lot of tax information, which is highly confidential. Child support obviously deals with confidential information. The Social Security numbers we take another level of concern with. So when an employee fills out, or a potential employee, fills out the questionnaire, for current employees, those come directly to me. I'm the only one in our agency that gets those copies. I keep them under lock and key until I take them to the criminal investigation unit. There's only one employee there that runs the background check for us. And then that employee retains that in a locked file. And so there's a chain of custody. There's no one else that can see those. Certainly, I could breach the confidentiality or be the person that's stealing it or the other employee, but there are only two other people that have that. For a new employee, somebody that's applying for a job, there's also a hiring supervisor that would get that. So there's a third person in that chain for new hires. There's a risk there that a hiring employee or hiring supervisor could go make a copy or write it down. We realize that there is a risk, but it's unfortunately, in order to do the background check, we have to have that piece of information.
It's a people business and people. Senator Wilkowski, you get the last question, and we're going to call it a day.
Thank you. Are you aware of any state employees ever misusing federal tax information in the state of Alaska?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I believe Carol Bleacher's on the line, and she may be able to respond better to whether it was federal tax information. But I know that in the child support, they did terminate several employees that were accessing information that they didn't have business reason to be accessing, and I believe that there was the potential for federal tax information within that, we have had. Certain breaches of information within the tax division, one of which I'm aware of, that there was discipline and termination involved with that. Other breaches were simply mistakes sent to the wrong email. We have a procedure that we follow for that. None of that involved federal tax information. That was all state tax information.
And I'm going to let Carol off the hook because I think you probably gave a pretty good summary of that. Well, thank you very much, Genevieve, Brandon, right? I think we're going to hold the bill over, but I think we got into the questions that we want to get answered. The effective date is something I'll probably bring to back up to date as a committee. I'm going to lay that Senate bill aside for now. Just out of curiosity, is it in the House and moving?
Mr. Chair, it is in the House, and there were a couple of representatives that asked for an opportunity for amendments, and so it's Friday. They'll have another hearing, and then they intended to move it.
All right. Just not that we will wait or do on purpose what they did. I just wondered if it was thank you very much. We're going to lay this bill aside, and we'll pick it up again next week probably, and with that, we're adjourned.